by side, some of whom are paid, some of whom are unpaid. For example, at the Oregon State Correctional Institution, we have 103 inmates who are employed in the culinary department, and of that group, 60 are paid and 43 are unpaid. And the same applies to the other institutions. So from our perspective, we believe this bill to be unfair and discriminatory to inmates who are engaged in authorized but unpaid employment in the institutions. And finally, although this is speculative, it's our view that enactment of this bill may result in inmate lawsuits to obtain compensation for medical costs that are incurred subsequent to their release, but related to an on-the-job injury while they were incarcerated if this bill is enacted and existing benefits are eliminated.
What if we just eliminated compensation for paid workers? That'd certainly take care of the discrimination problem, wouldn't it? No one would get compensation.
Well, that's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Well, all right. What? Give me the history of this law. I mean, I didn't even know it existed. The history and the rationale for a law that provides for compensation for inmates that are injured on prison jobs. Is that a long-standing law in Oregon? Or?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that this is a long-standing law. And although inmates are not paid more than a total of $3 a day, the significant cost that can be incurred is for ongoing medical treatment subsequent to their release from a correctional institution. And under this bill, that coverage, that potential for coverage under the injured inmate fund would be eliminated.
Yeah, I realize that. Any other questions? Well, okay, the way the law works now, if somebody gets paid $3 an hour at the top and is injured and requires some ongoing medical treatment after the release date, so the person's out in the general community and has to go to the doctor occasionally. And under present law, now that is a cost that the state picks up. Is that it?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
And that's... Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I would note that inmate pay is a maximum of $3 per day.
Right, but the total medical expenses would, of course, be, I assume, just like workers' comp, the total medical expenses would be picked up. But to take care of these, of the inmates who are have been released, is that true?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, well, I didn't know that we even had that system. But so, what would an inmate receive then? Suppose an inmate was getting $3 an hour working in the kitchen, and burned his hand and couldn't go back to work for 2 or 3 months. Now, what kind of compensation would that inmate get under this law here?
Well, under the existing law, the inmate is, Mr. Chairman, the inmate is not entitled to compensation while they are incarcerated.
Okay.
Compensation is only paid subsequent to their release.
All right. So when what... Is it a percentage of their hourly rate, or do you know?
Mr. Chairman, the workers' compensation laws and the percentages of compensation are utilized. The dollar value of benefits is very minimal. It's a percentage of $3 per day.
The same kind of parallels the regular workers' comp benefits, then. Is that it?
That's correct.
So it certainly
Chairman.
Would be minimum, I'm sure of that. About a buck and a half an hour.
Got a permanent partial disability. There's a fellow out there today, we saw that he got 50% of his body burned by somebody who threw a flammable liquid on him while he was working, as I recall, the way it was described to us, and ignited it. And that would be a large permanent partial disability claim. He certainly won't ever work again as a retail clerk. He's got the scar build up all over his face and hands. So he would if, I don't know whether he was being compensated or not, but he would not, he would be able to make a sizable permanent partial disability claim under this, but if we abolished this, then he could sue.
Any other questions? Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Cawley. I take it that it's safe to say that the proposed revisions contained in Senate Bill 214 are more than housekeeping in nature. All right, let's see. We have, okay, Jim Edmondson, come on up.
Mr. Kuykendall still in the room?
Yes, he's back there.
Did you propose an amendment to the bill regarding the eligibility of inmates on the employment issue, the nature of employment? Because I think this witness, Mr. Edmondson, is going to talk to the proposed amendment, and I'm not sure whether the committee's been informed about the proposed amendment or if it made it into the committee files.
Mr. Chairman and Council, if I may respond, I think we can clarify a little bit of what we are intending to do here.
Well, just a minute. Let's find.
Just
we've got an amendment sitting up there. We don't know who's the author of it.
Okay. We are the author of the amendment. The Department of Justice has submitted the proposed revision to the statute, and it is not intended to disenfranchise any inmates who have rights already. For a number of years, we have had an Attorney General opinion in operation that limited us to compensating those inmates who were in paid authorized employment. It's merely a situation where the wording of the existing statute does not clearly state the fact that they must be paid.
Okay, well, listen, now, Mr. Edmondson, were you going to speak about that amendment? Is that it?
My understanding, the amendment was before the committee, and I didn't
Well, okay,
to speak
we don't have, the committee members the haven't seen this.
We're going to get a copy.
We're going to get copies, so I guess we can't really be too smart about this as you testify until we've seen it, so why don't we go on to something else? We'll come back to you if you don't mind.
That's fine.
We got another short bill, and we'll go to that. Let's go to Senate Bill 294.
I guess we do have a copy of the amendment.
We do?
This is it?
Apparently.
That's it.
I had it in my bill file.
In our extra bill folders here at our desk.
All right.
No, I mean at our station.
94 or wait?
go ahead. Wait. Just a minute. Okay. Mr. Kuykendall, I don't leave yet. We're going to get back on this one here.
There it is. Yeah.
Mr. Edmondson, come on up. We've got it. Apparently, we have this tucked away in some other folder. What's
in our 214 folder?
It was in my
book
folder,
it's right
214.
Here. Yes, that's it.
No. It's in our regular
one. They provide. Like this?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, I see. All right. Okay, let's just take a minute here then, members, and take a look at this thing. On page one. Page 1, line 19. Where the injury is proximately caused by or arising out of, no. Page 1, line 19.
Right here.
Where the, after or insert, all right. Where the injury is proximately caused by or arising out of and received in the course of. Okay, we're ready? Go ahead, identify yourself.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Edmondson. I live at 1460 Oak Drive in Eugene, and I'm an attorney practicing in workers' compensation matters. I asked to testify today on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association because our concern is that this bill may create a standard that is different than that employed in workers' compensation cases generally. And we refer the committee to line 12 of page 1, which provides that, and this is not to be changed or anything in the law, but it provides that the injury is as defined as provided in ORS Chapter 656. That's the Workers' Compensation Act. The amendment adds the language arising out of and received in the course of paid authorized employment. Our concern is that language may not include all sorts of injuries that an inmate might receive, which would, if injured in the normal course of employment outside the incarceration, would be covered under workers' compensation. Specifically, arising out of employment and in the course of employment are terms of art in workers' compensation matters. They mean, and this is what our Supreme Court in a case, Phil Livesley Company versus Russ, the citation's 296 Oregon 25, 1983. That those words mean that an injury occurs during working hours, on work premises, and while performing a task for the employer's benefit. That is the course of employment, how the worker is situated at the time of the injury. Arising out of employment, that the language that you have here requires a causal link between the injury and a risk connected with the employment. Now, that includes harassment, horseplay, assaults by other co-workers on a worker. Not where a worker is the aggressor, or where the worker is engaged in something that has nothing to do with the employer's business. But if a worker is on the job site and for any reason injured while performing a task that he's there to do, that's covered. Our concern is that if arising out of and received in the course of language is added to this bill, that it may limit the course of employment. In other words, that it may limit claims where inmates are injured while they're not actually engaged in injured because of the task they're performing.
A riot.
You are at the workplace and there's a riot, no fault of your own, you're standing, you're hit by a brick. If you were in the factory, that would clearly be covered under workers' compensation laws. Our concern is that this language might exclude that sort of coverage for an inmate similarly situated, and we would urge the committee to simply make sure that the coverage provided under Chapter 655 is the same as provided under 656. I have a personal interest in this because I represented an injured worker in a case, Safe versus Knopfzinger, which I have provided to counsel, where my client, Mr. Knopfzinger, was injured as a result of horseplay while he was working in a mill. The Department of Justice urged the Supreme Court, and it denied review in the case, and it urged the Court of Appeals, which affirmed, but it urged the court to limit the coverage of injuries to those injuries which were as the result of the work activity itself. In other words, this man ran a clipper in a veneer plant. They would have had his injuries limited to injuries while operating the clipper, not from the harassment that he was subjected to. This argument was premised on an argument of what arising out of employment means. And my concern is that the department is attempting to codify its interpretation of workers' compensation coverage in this bill, and we would be very much opposed to that.
The Supreme Court did take review in this case.
No, the Supreme Court denied review and did not accept the position advanced by the Department of Justice in that case.
Oh, I see. The Court of Appeals decided that...
It was covered.
It was covered, I see. Yeah.
It was resisted quite heavily, and this bill causes me some concern that this is also an issue here. It's really all...
Well, in other words... You take one phrase of art received in the course of employment, and that's got a meaning, and you take another term of art arising out of employment, and that's got a meaning, but when you put the two together, we really don't know what it's going to mean. Is that what you're kind of suggesting?
That's my concern, is we don't have in the course of employment and arising, that in the course of language included there, it does not track with the workers' compensation laws, which do include that language. So we would just urge any language defining the type of activity which an injury can occur, any of that language be the same as workers' compensation laws.
Well, unless you were, unless you were representing injured inmates, you wouldn't really care, would you?
That is true.
Because it certainly wouldn't affect any other parts of the workers' comp law.
No, I don't want to presuppose how the courts might want to refer to this by analogy, but yes, it is clearly an injured inmates, and for that matter, I have represented injured inmates. So they have a right to counsel, and we do advise them in their claims. And we advise them under the laws of workers' compensation, as indicated earlier, that is the standard for the Injured Inmate Act. And we just want that to remain the standard of the Injured Inmate Act.
Well, what do you think about this? And you wouldn't want to tamper with the law that allows medical expenses of inmates after release to be paid by the state then?
We have no position really on that. Our concern is that the laws be the same, and that we do not have a different standard defining the type of activity for an injury will be compensable.
Okay, as I understand this law, an inmate, as long as he's incarcerated, wouldn't receive any compensation for an injury on the job. But if he's released, then he would. Is that it?
Yeah, my understanding is that there is actual award process for an injury in incarceration. There's no appeal rights until the worker is released. There's no award. There's no actual cash delivered. As a practical matter, temporary disability or wage loss isn't a factor because they are incarcerated. The permanent disability, as a question, arises, and they can litigate that after they're released. But they have to wait until they're released. It's very similar to workers' compensation, and then a referee from the workers' compensation department will hear that, have a hearing and hold it. And it's
okay. Any questions,
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Wires?
One quick one. Mm-hmm. What is your reaction to Mr. McCauley's testimony that this could open up, I don't know if you've got a copy of it, but his last point, paragraph 3, that this could apparently open up the possibility of bringing lawsuits?
Well,
Tort claims.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wires, when a worker, generally an inmate, I assume, is given compensation, is provided compensation, that's an exclusive remedy, and they do not have a right of action for negligence against the tortfeasor unless they are a third party not in the employment situation. I'm not sure how it would affect civil rights actions. I would question
whether...
Well,
just stay on that for a second.
Okay.
This printed bill goes to... pains to say receiving pay. So
yes.
Mr. Colley thinks that means that those who aren't receiving pay wouldn't be covered, so then they wouldn't have the exclusive remedy.
Correct.
Then wouldn't they be able to, when they get out of the penitentiary, sue
yes.
in a lawsuit
for negligence?
For damages.
Yes.
You agree with him?
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I wonder if that was this law enacted in as a result of the Tort Claims Act.
I don't know. I'm sorry. I just don't know the history of this particular act.
I guess up until then, why an inmate couldn't have sued the state anyway for negligence, could it?
At all? I would not think so.
Well, all right,
Mr. Edmondson.
Counsel.
Mr. Kuykendall referred to the committee a compensation case of Charles Speer in support of the amendment. Have you gotten a chance to take a look at that case?
I don't believe that's been reported yet, and I haven't received a copy of the actual order on review or the
opinion.
Well,
let me just ask you a question based on that. In the case, there's a suggestion that if we had a rising out of limitation, if we had the amendment language, that would somehow restrict what activities would be covered. That's what the workers' comp case says. Now, you've also referred the committee to the Safe versus Knopfinger case, and it seems to me that case suggests that whether you have the arising out of language is not a limitation. That is, for instance, these harassment activities would still be covered.
That's correct. When it arises out of employment and in the course of employment, which is the full phrase, not just arising out of, but that is considered to be anything that happens to the worker, whether it's as a result of the assigned job task or not, yes. And to suggest that adding that language would somehow limit is not right. That is exactly wrong. The arising out of in the course of employment language, which Mr. Nofsinger relied on, where he was injured, or actually a disease arose due to harassment, the court held that that was a broad term which encompassed all but the greatest deviations from work, where if a worker, for example, decides to leave the premises of work by climbing over a barbed wire fence rather than using the gate, that's not in the course of employment. If they are injured while being the aggressor in a fight, that's not in the course and scope, we call it course and scope of employment. But if any other injury or illness befalls them at employment, that is considered in arising out of and in the course of employment. So I would have to disagree with the conclusion of that referee that that sort of language would have affected anything.
Any other questions? Okay, thanks.
Thank you
very much for coming here. And that's no other witness on Senate Bill 214. We'll close the public hearing on that. And we'll have Senate Bill 294. Mark Comstock, come on.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, counsel, my name is Mark Comstock. I appear before you on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Practice and Procedure Committee. There is prepared testimony in your packets, and I've also given you a copy of a survey that the Practice and Procedure Committee circulated to various sheriffs in the state of Oregon. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 294. I'm not planning to read the prepared testimony. Basically, what Senate Bill 294 does is reduces the statute of limitations for actions arising out of the sale or seizure of personal property post-judgment against the sheriff to make it conform to the realities of practice out in the trenches. Currently, insurance companies, surety companies will allow a one-year period for an indemnity bond to the sheriff, which the sheriffs require for a personal property post-judgment execution. At the expiration of that one-year period, the sheriff will request another renewal of the bond. The insurance company requests another premium, and the judgment creditor either says, yes, I will pay it, or no, I won't pay it. And if he does not pay it, then to preserve amicable relations, quite often the attorney has to put it out himself. What this would do is simply say there is a one-year period for bringing such an action.
Questions? Fine. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Comstock,
yes.
It appears to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that it is unclear as to whether the 1 year commences from the seizure or the sale.
I see the problem there, and the sale is always going to be the later date. So it will be that date.
Let me ask you if the following language would be consistent with your intent and would solve the problem. If you'd go to line 16 and after date, it would read, of the seizure, or if a sale occurs within 1 year from the date of the sale. So if there's just a seizure and if the parties get together and resolve things, it's 1 year from the date of the seizure. If a sale occurs, it's 1 year from the date of the sale.
I wouldn't have any difficulty with that change in language.
Do you think it's clear enough the way it's stated?
It's clear to me, representing creditors, certainly, but I can see where there could be a problem with it. The clarity is the sale date is what I would advise my client, if it's a private sale or if it's a public sale.
Well, a wrongful seizure could give rise to a cause of action, right?
That's correct. Right.
And like counsel points out, there never would be a sale.
Yes.
And so when the statute would start to run then at the time of the seizure in that case, or should, right?
Correct.
You can't have a
sale before the seizure, so it's going to be the later of either the two.
Well, but I think counsel's got a point here. I don't think it's clear from the date of seizure or sale. Why couldn't you argue, if this language were the law, that maybe it's been more than a year after the seizure, but less than a year after the sale. Now, couldn't you argue that the time's run then because it was a year after the seizure, or a year after the seizure's gone by?
Not because, as I see the language here, it's in the disjunctive, so I would say it would have to be the latter. A sale would occur.
Okay, well, that's not any big problem, but we'll think about it.
Okay.
I'll have counsel give that some thought. Any other questions?
Thank you.
All right. We have one bill left, Senate Bill 223, and we have Don Arnn.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Don Arnold. I am an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice, here speaking on behalf of Senate Bill 223. With me is Scott McAllister, the attorney in charge of our corrections section. Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 223 would amend ORS 12.160 by deleting subsection 3 of that statute. Subsection 3 provides for tolling of the statute of limitations for prisoners while they are serving time in prison. This provision was adopted at a time when Oregon provided for what is commonly known as civil death for felons during the time of their imprisonment. That meant, in effect, that prisoners lost most of their civil rights when convicted of a felony and sent to prison. Included among those civil rights was the right to bring lawsuits, civil lawsuits. In 1975, the legislature repealed the civil death statute, restored civil rights to felons, including the right to bring suits while in prison. That effectively eliminated the need for special treatment for prisoners while they were incarcerated. This bill recognizes that change and would delete subsection 3 from the statute. There are some obvious policy reasons for doing this. tolling of the statute of limitations is something we believe should occur only in the most extreme circumstances and situations where there is a very clear need for doing that. Obviously, the longer the time between the incident that gives rise to the cause of the suit and the time that the case is filed, the case comes to trial, the more problems there are involved in that case. Witnesses die, memories fade, records are lost. It becomes very difficult to defend that sort of case regardless of the merits of the suit. Mr. McAllister is here to give you some concrete examples of how that impacts on the state in defending against lawsuits. But I think what he has to say is really equally applicable to private litigants who may be sued by prisoners.
I just brought a couple of quick examples. The first example, and I just picked cases that we presently have pending, we have an inmate who sued us over a disciplinary action which occurred in 1979. Given the amount of time one normally would keep the tape of that proceeding, the number of witnesses who are around, frankly, everybody's disappeared, so we have no real practical way of defending a suit in which the contentions are involve the conduct of a hearings officer in a case in which all records